welcome to True Crime Medieval, 1,000 Years of People Behaving Badly. I'm Anne Brannan, and I'm your host in Albuquerque.
And I'm Michelle Butler in Tuscaloosa.
And today, our special episodes are when we, so far they've been when we go outside of the Middle Ages, because actually we go down into the early modern era, because we want to talk about, you know, people like Kit Marlowe. But this is sort of a special episode because we're not actually in Europe. But in other ways, it's not a special episode because it's like when Europe took its little self on over to the Holy Land and took some things over for a while and made a kingdom of Jerusalem, which did not last forever. Yay. But that's where we are, because we want to talk about the time that Queen Melisende of Jerusalem was accused of adultery in 1134. So first, our context, how we get here. And so that's me. In 1099, we're going backwards. In 1099, the First Crusade, see our previous podcast on the First Crusade. That is the Prince's Crusade, because the Peasants' Crusade also was that year, but it left earlier because the peasants didn't have the wherewithal to get any resources. So instead of being an actual crusade, they were basically an unruly mob that slaughtered the Jews of Europe and then ended up getting slaughtered by the Turks themselves just a few months later. So they never made it to the Holy Land. But the Prince's Crusade, this would be the crusade. Well, I don't want to say crusade proper since it's a god-awful thing, but at any rate, the crusade that actually got to the Holy Land, that was made up of people who could get the money and resources together to put together an actual military force in order and to go over a very large piece of the world to get over someplace else entirely. So in the Prince's Crusade consisted of four main armies. They were led by Raymond of Toulouse and Godfrey of Bouillon and Bohemond of Tarente and Robert Curthose. And they fought their way through Anatolia, and they ended up getting to Jerusalem, which was, you know, where they were headed. They got to Jerusalem in June of 1099. And they took Jerusalem and slaughtered the Muslim and Jewish inhabitants of Jerusalem because they were a holy force, which is often a very bad thing. And so they had Jerusalem. Later, most of the crusaders were going to be going home. That's after they had repulsed a counterattack at Ascalon. And that was the end of the First Crusade. But there remained enough crusaders to establish four crusader states. The most important of them was the Kingdom of Jerusalem, and Godfrey of Bouillon won the election for the leadership of that state. He and his knights had been the first to actually break into Jerusalem. And Raymond of Toulouse, who was the oldest and the richest of the crusade leaders, refused the crown of Jerusalem because he didn't want to rule the city where Jesus died. At least that's what he said, but we think there were actually really political reasons for this. But anyway, he didn't want to do it. He refused. And so Godfrey agreed to rule the Christian state of Jerusalem, though he wouldn't call himself king. He called himself the advocate of the Holy Sepulchre because he didn't want to wear a crown of gold in the city because Jesus wore a crown of thorns. So he didn't want to wear a gold one. All right, so he is not the king of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. He is a prince and the advocate of the Holy Sepulchre. And the other three states, by the way, were Edessa. Baldwin of Boulogne became the Count of Edessa, and Antioch, and Bohemond of Tarento was the Prince of Antioch, and Tripoli, and Raymond of Toulouse, same guy who refused the rulership of Jerusalem, he became the Count of Tripoli. Okay, so the Crusader state of Jerusalem, Godfrey was the advocate of the Holy Sepulchre and Prince of Jerusalem, and he died the next year. And so his brother, Baldwin, this is the same guy who had been the Count of Edessa, Baldwin became the ruler, And he did not mind wearing a gold crown in the city where Jesus had worn thorns. So he was crowned the king of Jerusalem. He's the first king of the kingdom of Jerusalem. And he was crowned in the church of the Holy Sepulchre, which he wasn't the advocate of. He was the king of. Okay. And the kingship was, it was sort of elective and sort of hereditary. It was a new construction. And so traditions and rules for transferring power hadn't been created. It was a really sort of a mix of choppy and fluid sort of power dynamic going through the kingdom of Jerusalem. So the next king was Baldwin II. He wasn't Baldwin's son. He was actually a cousin of Baldwin. He was the son of Hugh and Melisande of Montpellier, who was French. And then Baldwin II, their child, married Morphia, and she was an Armenian princess. She was Christian. She was Greek Orthodox, but she was Armenian. And they were the parents of Melisande, our protagonist. And so we come to our story proper. She was 13 when her father was elected king of Jerusalem. Baldwin and Morphia had only daughters. But despite the fact that their marriage had been a political alliance, Baldwin was really devoted to Morphia, and so he would not divorce her, although he was advised to get rid of her. He would not get rid of her to get another wife and a chance to have sons. So he had his daughters, that was it. And he raised Melisande as his heir, taught her and told everybody she was his heir. She co-signed documents with her father, and she was supported by the royal council. And so when she herself was put into a marriage as a political alliance, there were some problems. Baldwin asked Louis, the king of France, to suggest a Frankish noble, because it was really important to keep the Crusader state of Jerusalem connected to France and to the rest of Europe, because it was really a sort of small little bunch of people, and they were by themselves out in this land. They needed to have support, manpower and connections. They needed them from Europe. Anyway, so Louis wanted Fulk, who was the Count of Anjou and Maine, to be married to Melisande, because Fulk was rich and he was powerful. He was a powerful warrior. And it would be great to get him out of France, where he was kind of problematic for Louis. By the way, here's another connection here. Fulk had been married before, and his son Geoffrey, from that marriage, was married to Matilda, the daughter of Henry I, King of England. And she had previously been married to the Holy Roman Emperor, and later she was going to enter into a civil war with her cousin Stephen of Blois, for the throne of England, because she was the heir of Henry I, since he also had no sons, no legitimate sons to inherit the throne.
On account of the white ship, which we covered.
Yes, we refer you to our previous podcast, well, two of them, the white ship where Henry's heir died, and Stephen of Blois, who said that he would go along with the agreement for Matilda to be the Queen of England, broke his oath. We have two of them. I think that's only two of them on that one, yeah?
Yeah, I think so.
So Fulk is great, and he's powerful, and he was maybe going to be connected to the throne of England, you know? That was going to be great, and everything was wonderful, except that during the negotiations, Fulk demanded that he would be the only ruler of Jerusalem. He did not want for Melisande to be the ruler of Jerusalem, and he didn't even want to share this rulership of Jerusalem. Baldwin agreed to this because, you know, he wanted this marriage, but he thought there might be some problems, not only because Melisande wouldn't be the queen of Jerusalem on her own, but also he thought that there might well be some problems if Fulk would got rid of her later, because he had children from a previous marriage, and he might want another one of his sons, who wasn't Geoffrey and already very busy, to become the king of Jerusalem, and so he might get rid of Melisande. So they got married, and then Melisande had a son. This was great. She named him Baldwin because it's good to name everybody the same thing. Later, you can have your people who are trying to explain history get into problems. And her dad named her the sole guardian of her son. And then her dad died, and Fulk and Melisande became co-rulers of Jerusalem, which you remember Fulk did not want. And he wasn't good at sharing power. he wouldn't let Melisende do any of the royal duties, and he told everybody that she didn't have any authority. And the royal council, you remember, they supported Melisende, did not like him, and they did not like his rulership, and so things were not good. In 1134, Fulk accused Melisende of adultery with Hugh of Jaffa, who was one of her father's cousins and one of her supporters, because it was going to be a way to get rid of Melisende and Hugh also. And I believe that Michelle is going to tell us more about this later. But at any rate, sources at the time say that the accusation was unfounded, and the church and the royal council and the nobles all continued to support her. And so we don't think that Melisende had an affair with Hugh of Jaffa. We think that Fulk was just falsely accusing her to get rid of her. Hugh went to Ascalon. He fled to Ascalon, and it was a Muslim city, and he had held off Fulk's forces, and there was a negotiated peace, and he got exiled for 3 years. And there was an assassination attempt against him, and Fulk was blamed for that. And then there was a palace coup, and Melisande's supporters took over, and Fulk became not very powerful at all, and his supporters were terrified into submission, and Melisande was the boss. They did reconcile, and they had another son, and Melisande was actually in grief when Fulk died, which I find hilarious. He died in a hunting accident, by the way. You always want to know, was he poisoned? Did he fall out of a window? No, it was a hunting accident.
It apparently was a bad hunting accident. The descriptions are bad. They were out together, and a hare started up out of the bushes, and he took off after the hare, and the horse stumbled, and Fulk went off his horse, landed on his head.
Oh, Jesus.
The saddle came off, too. His cinch broke. Saddle also clipped him on the head. And, I mean, it's described as he has blood and, like, brains coming out of his nose. So there was no chance. There's no chance he was ever coming back from it. It was bad. And she was there with him. So she saw this whole thing happen.
Well, that's traumatic. I don't like Fulk, and I think he's an idiot, but I am sorry that he died in that horrible fashion, because it sounds very bad, although it was probably pretty quick for him, and so...
Yeah, he doesn't die for like 3 days, but...
He did suffer. Ah!
No, I don't think so, because I think he was brain dead. I mean, his heart doesn't stop beating. He never regains consciousness.
Oh, well, that's good. Okay. That's good for him. All right.
But yeah, I mean, poor Melisende, she was like right there with it and saw this whole thing happen.
Well, it wasn't. He wasn't assassinated. He actually died in a hunting accident.
There's so many of these hunting accidents, though.
Mm-hmm. We refer you to our previous podcast on William Rufus, the King of England, who died in a hunting accident at the New Forest. I like it that we've gone so far into this. We're almost at our fourth anniversary. It'll be coming up in a couple months. We've gone so far into this that really we have lots of podcasts to refer to. And so, as usual, I want to put the rest of the story in context, because I think that's, I like that part. So Melisende was the queen of Jerusalem. She all by herself. And she gave money and riches to religious houses. She had a school of bookmakers and manuscript illuminators. Before he died, Fulk had commissioned what we call the Melisende Psalter. He was being all nicey-nicey and, you know, getting reconciled at that point. And it still exists. It's held by the British Library in London, and it's gorgeous. It's still got its carved ivory covers. And the illustrations in it are made, well, at least some of these illustrations are made by Basilius, who actually signed the last illustration. He's the only name that we know of scribes and illustrators for that manuscript. But he actually signed one, which is unusual. And by the early 19th century, it was owned by a monastery in France. And then it was owned by the head of the Fine Arts Museum at Lyon. And it shows up next, owned by this Italian who is renowned for stealing medieval manuscripts from French libraries, and he sold it to her.
Oh, I didn't look any of this up. I was busy.
I like to know provenance, yeah.
Oh, I'm glad you did, because I did not look up. I just, you know, it's it's a thing from the Middle East showing up in the British Museum. I just sort of assumed theft.
Colonialism is your usual answer. But in this case, it's a different thing. It's like when the Crusaders left, obviously, it got taken back to France. Most of them were actually more or less French. And it's that guy. It's the thief who sold it to the British Museum in 1845. Yeah, because I had wondered myself, especially because I'm used to things showing up in the British Museum because British people found them and took them back. But I'm like, how is this ending up in England? So I wanted to know. Mm-hmm. Why England? Because the English are not hanging out here, if you see what I mean.
Right, right.
Melisande was instrumental in bringing about the Second Crusade in 1144 because she asked the Pope for help when Edessa fell. And the crusaders of the Second Crusade talked to Melisande's son. This would be Baldwin III, as you remember. He was 18 at the time. To attack Damascus, which was a Muslim city that had been on good terms with Jerusalem. It's like, because the rest of them were like, no, Edessa, take Edessa. But, you know, he went and attacked Damascus. And so then Damascus never trusted the Crusaders again. And that was a lot less support for the Frankish kings of Jerusalem, I swear. Baldwin III was crowned co-ruler in 1145 with Melisande, and he got better at governance, but he fell out with his mother, and he wanted to be crowned sole ruler, and the patriarch refused to do that, and so he paraded around the streets wearing a laurel wreath, and the royal council ended up dividing the kingdom between them, and Melisande kept Jerusalem. Yay, and he got like the north of the territory. And Baldwin attacked Jerusalem and took it. And Melisande fled, and negotiations held by the church at that time resulted in her losing Jerusalem, but being given some lands to rule. And she and Baldwin got along after that, because she was an excellent counselor. But she died in 1161. She had a stroke and she died, and she had ruled Jerusalem for 30 years. The Crusaders, by the way, would lose Jerusalem to Salah al-Din in 1187. Yay. And the Third Crusade reestablished the kingdom, but not in Jerusalem. They established it in Acre. And then the Sixth Crusade got some of Jerusalem back, but then they lost it. 1244, it was over. There were no more Franks and descendants of Franks in Jerusalem. Except, you know, like if they were doing one of those tourist pilgrimage things where you get to go and the Franciscan friars drag you around and show you stuff. That was it. But Melisande, she ruled Jerusalem. She was Queen Melisande. She did not commit adultery with her cousin Hugh. And she was quite powerful and educated and interesting. And I believe, Michelle, you have a lot of things you want to say.
I really enjoyed this research. I had not heard of Melisande before, but when I ran across this, accusing a queen of adultery is treason. So committing the adultery would be a crime. So that's why I put it on the list.
Now, I do have to remind us that it isn't treason everywhere. It wasn't treason in Wales. The reason Llewellyn hung William de Braes, it wasn't Welsh law at all that William de Braes was going to die for having an affair with the queen, but Llewellyn was just having a fit.
He was just mad.
Yeah, but yeah, these are the Franks, and so yeah.
Right. Okay. I agree. I don't think there's any chance that Melisande, who we have ever reason to believe was a level-headed, logical sort of person, would have risked everything. Her father raised her to be his heir. She was in training from the time she was 13. She spoke four languages. She was literate. She was a huge patron of Fulk when he needed to buy his way back into her good graces, picked a good bribe. She had established a scriptorium at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And she had established a monastery, and not a monastery, a convent for her younger sister became a nun. And
oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Melisande didn't think it was okay for the youngest sister to just be a plain nun in a different monastery. So she established a convent with the understanding that the old abbess who she put in place first would teach Yvette, and then Yvette would become the abbess after her, which is what happened.
It's brilliant because she didn't just stick Yvette in the position as abbess. She had her trained. That's really smart.
Well, then, and of course, the other nuns know the score, right? So they know to elect her as the next abbess. But yeah, she had some on-the-job training from this older woman who obviously was experienced but was not going to live forever so that Yvette could. But, you know, so Melisande is a really important patron of the arts. But to circle back to Hugh for a second, Hugh and Melisande knew each other as children. They were almost raised together as brother and sister. I just don't believe that, you know, ew, right? he was orphaned. His parents, the dad and the mom, were on their way from France to participate in the crusade, and the mom was pregnant, so they stopped and she had the baby, and then the dad was like, "We're gonna leave the baby here because we'll travel better without a newborn." And so they left the baby, which turned out to be the only reason he survived, because they came to the Holy Land and promptly both got sick and died.
So they didn't. It isn't like I was waiting to hear that the ship foundered, but no.
No, they both got sick. So Baldwin sent for the orphaned child, who is now a lord, right? Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. He was raised in his household.
They knew each other.
They were friends, certainly, but they were cousins. They were mm-hmm. more like siblings. It's mm-hmm. weird. But also Melisande is just way too savvy. Mm-hmm. Way too savvy. There is no way she's gonna put Baldwin, her son's legitimacy, at risk.
Yeah, and that's not even counting her religious nature. She's actually She's got a kind of solid Christianity to her.
Yeah, she's just wonderful. I enjoyed reading about her so much. And I'd never heard of her, which I'm troubled by the idea that I've spent decades as a medievalist and not have heard of Melisande of Jerusalem.
It turns out, though, that, you know, sometimes you and I run across these things like, I've never heard of this, and we really ought to have, but there's an enormous amount of material. Okay, fine. But if we hadn't heard of her, it's because she wasn't getting talked about.
Yeah, I find it interesting that I learned as an undergraduate about women in the Middle Ages who failed to rule, not the ones who successfully ruled. There was a narrative that the Middle Ages was this time period in which women just couldn't cut it. But then there's Queen Elizabeth. So it was part of this conversation about the transition between the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. And Elizabeth I was always being held up as, well, she was able to do it. But, you know, oh, well, asterisk, Eleanor of Aquitaine. But what are you going to do? It's Eleanor of Aquitaine. She's definitely the outlier. The rest of them all failed. So there was a lot of conversation about Maud. I'd heard of Empress Maud. The narrative was, in the 12th century, England just wasn't ready to have a queen regnant. But by the 16th century, Queen Elizabeth was able to pull it off. That was the narrative. I think that's questionable.
So the idea is very much that the humans got smarter than they were in the horrible Dark Ages and were able to actually occasionally listen to women.
Yes, it's part of the conversation about the backwardness of the Middle Ages. And of course, you can't have people like Melisande and her sister Alice and all these other women who are reigning in their own right as part of that, because it disrupts the narrative.
Yeah, yep, yep.
So one of the lovely things about this, since we're dealing with the early 12th century and the Normans love writing histories, so we have lots of primary sources. Yay!
Yay.
The big one is William of Tyre, who has nice things to say about Melisande. I think she did a good job. Our friend Orderic Vitalis is back, who has not nice things to say about Fulk.
Please share the not nice things about Fulk, because I've gotten over the sadness that I had briefly when he had the bad accident. Now I'm back to despising him. What you got?
What Orderic says is that the reason Folk got in trouble is that, quote, he acted without the foresight and shrewdness he should have shown and changed governors and other dignitaries too quickly and thoughtlessly.
He was an idiot.
He showed up with a bunch of Angevin hangers-on, right? His retainers. And the people who had already been in Jerusalem resented getting sidelined. Quite reasonably, they resented getting sidelined.
And also, although we completely disapprove of the Crusades, I can note that these were people who had kind of done a lot of work to get there, as opposed to just being sent over by the King of France.
So they resented that. Bernard of Clairvaux, who normally I would not have a kind word to say for, has nice things to say to Melisande too.
All righty. So Bernard of Clairvaux we're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah, the guy whose skull you can still go see over in the reliquary.
He normally is kind of priggish.
So. Yeah. And he was, we refer you to our previous podcast about Abelard.
But he writes to her, and remember which scholar I was reading, because I read a whole bunch. One of them made the point that Bernard does not write to her and say, you need to marry again right away. You need to defer to your son. Like you need to defer to your counsel. He doesn't say any of that to her. What he says to her is, quote, with the king, your husband, dead and the young king not yet ready to bear the business of the kingdom and carry out the whole office of king, the eyes of all look to you, and on you alone the whole weight of the kingdom falls.
Wow.
You must put your hand to strong things and show a man in a woman doing what is done in the spirit of counsel and fortitude. You must dispose all things so prudently and moderately that all who see them will think you a king rather than a queen from your acts, lest perhaps the people might say, where is the king of Jerusalem? So I was astonished to read that Bernard wrote to her and said, you need to act like a king.
I would not have expected this from Bernard of Clairvaux. I'm quite surprised.
Utterly astonished that he wrote that to her. And we have, like you mentioned, we've got the charters from Melisande and Fulk. We've got Melisande's letters. It's pretty exciting to have all these sources. You talked about the Psalter, which is wonderful. Wonderful.
The Psalter is beautiful. It really is.
It's a blending of the styles of Western Europe with the styles of Byzantium, with the Armenian heritage. It's such an interesting work.
So in the scriptorium and where the illustrations were happening, they pretty clearly had artists from the different cultures around.
Yeah. I think we could say she's at the forefront of developing a style that is a fusion of the pieces that are coming in there that is going to emerge as unique to the Kingdom of Jerusalem. I think that one of the reasons we have not heard of her is that there is a deliberate downplaying of Melisande by scholars in the 19th and 20th centuries.
It seems to me that if you're a scholar of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, it would be very hard to not talk about 30 years of a reign in a rather not very long-lived kingdom.
So I have a couple of quotes about this. So this one is from Sharon Newman's. This is the only full-length biography, the one that was written in 2014.
Less than 10 years ago, this was published.
Melisande had fought many battles in her life. What she had no way to fight was the blackening of her reputation by later historians. In the 20th century alone, she has been called a, quote, power-hungry queen dowager.
Whoa!
Quote, an authoritarian, even vindictive woman. And those are two different scholars, by the way. Now we're going on to a third
Where does the vindictiveness come from? One of the things I noticed about her was that she reconciled with her god-awful husband. She reconciled with her son, who really was very badly behaved as a son. She was kind of the opposite of vindictive.
Then third scholar, this guy in particular, goes out of his way to badmouth her. Eminent Crusade historian Hans Eberhard Mayer, in the only serious monograph written on Melisande's rule, persists in calling her the Queen Mother. So he refuses to acknowledge that she was Queen Regnant. While he admits that Baldwin's military career had been a series of defeats, he still sees Melisande as a woman who plotted to keep her son from power. There's another scholar, Danielle Park, who is supposed to have a book coming out about Fulk and Melisande, but I think it has been pushed back because it was supposed to come out this year, but I'm not finding a listing for it on the publisher that it's supposed to be coming out from. So I think perhaps the book isn't done yet. Anyway, so she's a scholar of Melisande, but her book is not coming out just yet. She has a different quote in an article about Melisande from that same scholar, though, Hans Eberhard Meyer. Her thirst for power was greater than her wisdom.
Whoa, that's amazing.
And then this, she spread her own tentacles toward Acre. So the phrasing is...
What did she have to do with that? That doesn't make any sense.
Unnecessarily mean, right?
Yeah, the whole tentacle. Yeah, even if somebody actually is power hungry and trying to get some kind of place, to use the word tentacles really is a particular flavor, which is not charming.
So he was writing in 1972. So he kind of sets this tone. Park, in her article, talks about how the people who follow William of Tyre, so there's a continuation of his chronicle by Sigebert, who accuses an anonymous queen, but he means Melisande, of complicity in the murder of Count Alphonse of Toulouse. So there are people who want to insinuate that she had somebody killed. Without a shred of evidence. Not a piece.
So this is right after the earlier chronicles.
Yes. The things that are contemporary, like William of Tyre, speak well of her. And then you have these later ones that are like, I don't know. So you have William of Nangis is another chronicler who was convinced that Melisande was not awesome. But the biggest thing that happens is that in the 19th and 20th century, you have scholars who just cannot wrap their brains around the idea that she ruled all by herself and that she resisted handing power over to her son when he came of age. But what Newman says about this is, I have read the same chronicles and charters as other historians and come to a different conclusion, the conclusion about plotting to keep the son from power. I believe that Melisande and a large part of the nobility of the kingdom did not think that Baldwin was ready to be the sole ruler.
He had been talked into attacking Damascus. That wasn't so great.
That's part of this that seems to get ignored, that she can't decide that on her own. She has the council behind her when they're also saying, oh, I don't know, maybe this 20-year-old dude is not quite ready to take over from his mom, who has 22 years of experience doing this and a good track record. We're not excited about doing this yet.
This Damascus won't even talk to us anymore. We send flowers.
There is an outlier scholar, though, from 1978, Bernard Hamilton's article, Women in the Crusader States, The Queens of Jerusalem, has very nice things to say about Melisande.
Oh, okay.
He is this outlier. The article doesn't focus just on her. It talks about several of the Queens of Jerusalem, but he makes the point that, maybe I'll just give you this quote, she was a truly remarkable woman who for over 30 years exercised considerable power in a kingdom where there was no previous tradition of any woman holding public office. And then he quotes William of Tyre, which I think we've already quoted. William of Tyre's comment that she was a very wise woman, fully experienced in all spheres of state business, who completely triumphed over the handicap of her sex so she could take charge of important affairs, has a patronizing ring to a 20th century ear. Few, however, would disagree with his judgment that, striving to emulate the glory of the best princes, she ruled the kingdom with such ability that she was rightly considered to have equaled her predecessors in that regard. So that's Bernard Hamilton quoting William of Tyre. And he doesn't go after Meyer, who's writing just a few years before him, but he clearly is creating a different narrative than what Meyer was saying. So Melisande is getting a lot more attention in the last 20 years. It's very exciting. We've got Sharon Newman's the full-length scholarly biography. It's called Defending the City of God. It's from 2014. There is a book that just came out by Catherine Pagonis called Queens of Jerusalem, The Women Who Dared to Rule. It was 2022. There is a play planned for spring of 2024.
Where?
The venue has not been announced. All I can find about this is on the author's website. Her name is Kate Moss, M-O-S-S-E, and it's called The Queen of Jerusalem. And what we're getting told is that it is a major commission celebrating Melisende, the extraordinary 12th century Queen of Jerusalem, who ruled over the Holy Land during one of the most turbulent centuries in history with the support and sometimes the opposition of her sisters. This untold women's history of the Crusader era. So that is still the way she's getting described as untold. Daniel Park makes the point that scholars know about her, but the larger, there is no presence in the larger popular imagination for Melisende like there is, say, for Eleanor of Aquitaine. Most people have heard of Eleanor of Aquitaine. But it just says venue to be confirmed, spring 2024.
Do we know who
We do not know who commissioned it. Mm-mm. She's mostly a novelist.
Well, this is great. Yay.
So that's pretty exciting. And there is a historical novel about Melisende from 1997 by Judith Tarr. It's called Queen of Swords. It is about Melisende, kind of. It does not, it's not third person attached to Melisende. What you have are a young French noblewoman named Rachildis who comes to the Holy Land looking for the brother who is now the heir because the father and the older brothers have died. So she's trying to find her brother to bring him back to take up his lordship back in France. He had participated in the crusade and now he needs to go home. And so the novel is about what she experiences and her interactions with the queen. It is historical fiction about Melisende, but it's observing her, not really spending time in her head. It's an enormous book, by the way. It's the audiobook is 22 hours long. Judith Tarr is just a wonderful writer. This isn't the first book she's written that is historical fiction set during the Crusader era. She's done several of those. It was totally bizarre to me to find this book because I was reading Judith Tarr. I was 13 years old when I first started reading Judith Tarr. So first of all, I'm not even going to pretend to be objective about this. This is somebody I read as a kid. Mm-hmm. And indeed, I was reading some of her Crusader historical fiction as a child.
But you hadn't come across this one.
I had not come across this one because this one came out in 1997 and I was in graduate school.
That's right, you were. That's
right, you were. I was not doing anything other than, I think, reading plays in 1997.
If she'd written it when you were a child, you would have known all about Melisende.
She has these two other Crusader novels that are set slightly later that I have read. But those came out when I was in middle school, and so I read those. I had already read those. But this one came out a little bit later, and I was busy reading a crap ton of plays. So you have one scholarly biography. You have one historical novel. And the novel is way before, and this is 1997. This is way before this current crop of new books. There's another book that I don't have because it's out of print and it's like $40. But there's this whole other book. Let me pull it back up here. That is about her. It's called Melisende of Jerusalem, The World of a Forgotten Crusader Queen. And it's from 2011. So it's part of this rediscovery of her. And it's specifically about her context, about the artistic context. It's not so much focused on her. It's trying to explain what her world was like. I would have liked to have had it, but it's quite expensive used, so I didn't get it. Also, wouldn't have got here in time. So we have this new interest in her, 2011, 2014, 2022, the play that's coming out. So really in the last 10 years. But Judith Tarr's book is from 1997. So our friend Stephen Runciman is back. You remember him?
Mm-hmm.
Because her book is largely using Runciman, because there's a bunch of stuff that isn't available to her that is this newer work.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So mostly she's working from Runciman. But it's a very different sort of book to show a historical figure being observed rather than trying to get inside their head and show us why they do what they do. That would be an entirely, I'm saying there's still an opening here for somebody else to come in.
So once again, we need for somebody to write a historical fiction book focusing on Melisende from her point of view. Yes.
Yes.
We often have things we need people to write. You know, they never do so far.
Daniel Park's chapter is the one that it'll be in our sources list is largely about Judith Tarr's book. I didn't think it was going to be because the title is The Memorialization of Queen Melisande of Jerusalem from the Medieval to the Modern. I thought this was going to be something else entirely, but it has an introduction about how she got badmouthed by a bunch of scholars, and then it talks largely about Judith Tarr's Queen of Swords.
Because she's kind of where things turn.
Yes, I think that that's probably true.
Wow.
I kind of feel bad for Hugh of Jaffa because he never did. He did not recover from that assassination attempt. He died.
Oh, well, it wasn't an assassination attempt then. It was an assassination?
He didn't die instantaneously, but he died fairly soon thereafter, about three months later in exile.
Oh, that is very, yeah, that's a sad life, yeah.
Fulk just makes so many mistakes, right? If he sent the assassin after Hugh, that was super dumb because the sympathy shifted on a dime. This is still a world in which, yes, we're going to murder each other. We're going to slaughter each other on the battlefield. But this kind of backdoor stabbiness is not acceptable.
Right.
So if he sent the killer, it's not a real assassin. It's a French knight who had no particular reason. He claimed that he was not sent by Fulk, but he was hoping for a reward after he did this.
Ooh, like the
exactly
killed Thomas a Becket.
Exactly like that. That's what he claimed, but nobody believed him.
No.
Because Hugh didn't show up. They arranged this. There was a duel, right? When the accusation was made of the... Because Fulk didn't make the accusation directly, right? He started rumors, and then he got Hugh's stepson, Walter, to actually make the accusation. But Walter is like the size of the mountain in Game of Thrones. He's absolutely enormous, and Hugh is not a big dude. So when Walter says, well, we'll just have to have, you know, I challenge you to a duel, then we'll sort it out. Hugh, in the heat of the moment, agrees, but then he goes home and realizes this is a trap. So he doesn't show up to the duel. And of course, that makes him look very guilty, right? So he has to flee and go into exile, which is when apparently Fulk, this dumb bunny, sends a killer after him, which then changes everybody's opinion back to, well, now we're on Hugh's side. So if he'd have just left well enough alone and let Hugh go off into exile, Hugh looks like a coward and like he's guilty.
Right.
But when they try to kill him in this backhanded way, then it shifts the sympathies back to Hugh.
And one of the problems is that pretty much Fulk, they didn't like Fulk anyway. And so that would have greased the...
Yep. It made it easy to go back to the person they actually liked.
Yeah. Who clearly was indeed the sort of person who would send an assassin in stupid fashion.
Yeah. A French knight. Wait. Who do we know who's French? Who could it have been?
Who could it be? I find it so interesting that Melisande and Fulk reconciled, though. I find that so interesting because it would have made sense if basically, you know, she kind of threw him out and never spoke to him again.
Well, but they did need, you know, you got to have the heir and the spare. And they did. They had both kids and they needed both of them. Baldwin only outlived her by a year.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
And then Almaric becomes king. There's a lot of speculation about why Baldwin doesn't marry earlier, and some of the people who don't like Melisande want to argue that she wasn't allowing him to get married because she didn't want there to be another queen. She didn't want, you know, like, that she's stunting his growth. But...
Yeah, like another queen was actually going to get crowned by the patriarch. I don't think so.
There's again, no reason to think that. There's no evidence that she was trying to stand in his way in that... The evidence appears to be that Baldwin just wasn't interested yet. He wanted to get out there and cut his teeth in battle, behaving exactly like you would expect a 20-year-old to behave. I don't have time for girls, Mom. I need to go kill some people.
Yeah, and wander around the streets of Jerusalem with laurel leaves on my head.
Fortunately, this second son was married by that point and already had child, so he was providing, although I think it's his son, Baldwin IV, who is the leper king.
The what? The leper king?
The leper king, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I believe because the brother would have been Baldwin III. I believe it's Amalric's son, Baldwin IV. Although I didn't look at that for this, so don't quote me.
Did he do any crimes? Because then we'll have to look him up later.
Poor soul. He caught leprosy as a young person and he didn't live real long. So that's what I have. I'm excited about having learned about her, and I'm glad that she's finally getting her due.
I'm looking forward to hearing about the play and also the new book.
I was happy to have some sources. That was cool. We've had a couple that were really hard to research, so it was nice to have some sources.
Yeah. It's really going to take you a long time to get over the saffron, isn't it?
Pretty irritated.
I love the saffron. The saffron was great. Yeah, so that was our discussion on Melisende, the Queen of Jerusalem. She actually was the queen. She did rule. She did not have an affair. And we don't think that, you know, she was trying to thwart her son either. We think that she was waiting till he grew up and didn't make stupid decisions. And so.
And it's highly likely her husband, Fulk, did in fact commit a crime and attempt to have Hugh assassinated.
Yeah. And Fulk was an idiot. So that's our stance on Melisende. And this has been True Crime Medieval, where the crimes are just like they are today, only with less technology. We can be found on Spotify and Apple Podcast and all the other places where the podcasts are hanging out. I'm laughing because I usually say Stitcher, but I've been informed that Stitcher is no more.
It's gone.
And you can find us at truecrimemedieval.com. True Crime Medieval is all one word. There's links to the podcast there and also links to the show notes and the transcriptions. And it's always illustrated with lovely things I find, with little blurbs. And you can leave comments for us. We love comments. And if you've got any medieval crimes that you think we should pay attention to, please let us know. We'll stick them on the list if they, you know, probably. I think every one that's we've got a suggestion for, we've been stuck on the list. And you can contact us through there, too. And so, yeah, so we're reachable. Yeah. Melisende. That's us. She's awesome. And Michelle has a new heroine. You often do get new heroines. It's like every time we do one of the women, you get new, except for Mabel Dubalem. I don't think she was a heroine.
No, not Elizabeth Bathory either, but
no.
Joanna of Naples.
Yes.
And Melisende.
And Jean de Clisson. Was she the pirate?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yes, but now
we're not officially a women's history podcast, but I do enjoy it when it pops up.
Yeah, we do pay attention. Yeah, and Melisende, she had a bad rap, as well as did Joanna, the Queen of Naples.
Okay, that's true. They went out of their way to slander her too.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's us. Next time you hear from us, we'll be in East Anglia. Bye.
Bye.